Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello and welcome to F1 Explains. I'm Katie Osborne and I am in the United States of America, dead smack actually in the middle in Nebraska currently. But my partner in crime here on F1 Explains is Christian Hugill, and he is not in Nebraska. He's in fact not at home either. Where in the world is Mr. Christian Hugill? Where is he?
Katie, this is the second time this season you've been able to use your song to introduce me, which I enjoy, because you're quite right, I am not at home. What I can see is a great big lake in front of me that looks beautiful on this nice sunny day in the UK. I can also see in front of me 9 Formula One cars in a very silvery, grey, spaceship-like looking reception. And behind the Formula One cars, Katie, I can see an actual real-life, you want to call it a garage. It's not a garage. It looks far more clean. It's like a scientific laboratory where they build actual Formula One cars. Katie, I am at the McLaren Technology Centre in Woking, England, the home of McLaren.
I'm pretty certain McLaren could use all of what you just said as a marketing tool. You described a factory and a headquarters so well and so eloquently and painted the picture. I feel like I'm right there with you.
Yeah, Katie, there's a lot to love about this place. This is the official Formula One podcast that exists to explain the sport we love, answer your questions about the sport we love. Katie, you and I run about the F1 paddock looking for experts to answer our listener questions, but also sometimes it takes us on the road to different places like here at MTC. As well as adoring the Formula One cars in front of me, Katie, there are two here with the iconic papaya livery that is beautiful. There's also the McLaren liveries from yesteryear, the chrome, the silver, the iconic sort of white and red. But would you like to know my favourite thing about the McLaren Technology Centre, Katie, that I can see in front of me at the moment?
Yes, obviously.
MTC is a beautiful, amazing glass-fronted building. It's stunning. In front of that glass, huge panes of glass that sort of curl round. It's not a flat-fronted building. It curves and curls. But because in front of the glass there is water, I've never seen the cleaning of the glass, Katie.
Oh, gosh, what a process that must be.
To clean the glass, some gentlemen are in the water, wearing full waterproof waders, cleaning the glass. They are in the lake. That is the dedication that you have to have to work for a Formula One team. You have to get into a lake to clean the windows. I love it.
I would like to know if they have to do that on the daily. That's what I want to know. In the rain, in the snow, in every morning or every midday, noontime rolls around and you get your waders on.
I would imagine it's not every day, but I will try and find out how often those people have to do that. But as I say, in front of me, there are Formula One cars. Beautiful, amazing Formula One cars. It always gives me such a buzz to see them up close, like I can see them now and in person. And this week, we're talking about the people who help the drivers get the best out of not only themselves, but also these cars in front of us. We are talking about performance engineers. As ever, this is a topic suggested by one of our brilliant F1 Explains listeners.
Hi, Christian and Katie. It's Alina from London here. Many thanks for the great pods. I'm a very seasoned F1 fan of more than 30 years, but you never stop learning since the sport never stops changing and evolving. So thank you for all the great work you do. I really enjoy it. I've always been curious about the way the various members of an F1 team interact with each other. Could you explain how the performance engineers, race engineers and strategists work together to get the best performance out on track? Thanks, looking forward to hearing the answer.
Thanks, Alina. Great question. Now, we know about race engineers. They're the ones we hear talking to the drivers on the radio, telling them to box, box, box. We've also spoken about them on a previous episode of F1 Explains. But as Alina says, there are others. Drivers also have performance engineers. These are engineers, but they're maybe a bit more like coaches. They look at every detail to make sure the driver is as fast as possible.
We've mentioned performance engineers a few times in the past, Christian, but I don't think we've ever taken a full dive and explored what they really do, like how they're different to the race engineers, how they all work together. So today we're going to be talking to someone who's done both of those jobs. McLaren's Tom Stallard is currently Oscar Piastri's race engineer, but previously he's worked as a performance engineer for drivers, including Jenson Button.
Now, Katie, Tom is in the building, but I am currently loitering in what is comfortably the world's fanciest reception here at McLaren HQ. And Katie, it's about to be lunchtime where we are, so I'm going to get out the way, go down to McLaren's shiny studio downstairs. Stay there, Katie. I will go and find Tom, and we'll have a chat to him about performance engineers, shall we? Tom, why do F1 teams have performance engineers first and foremost? And what are they there to do?
So the key thing that we don't have in Formula One is anyone who's really called the coach for the driver. They have trainers who deal with their physical preparation. But in terms of coaching them for how they're going to drive the car, how they're going to get the most out of the car, how they maximise their performance during the race, exploiting the tyres, the grip of the car, that sort of thing. That's done by people who are called engineer. And so that is, generally speaking, that's a combination of the race engineer and the performance engineer. But where the race engineer has a kind of overview of the driver's weekend, the performance engineer is really very focused on his performance and how to maximise his performance. So it's probably the role that is closest to coach within Formula One.
And does each of these drivers have their own dedicated performance engineer?
Effectively, yes. But actually, the performance engineer is a role within the team rather than a role within the driver's entourage.
I like how you say that, the entourage of the driver.
Yeah. They're employed across the board. They're employed by the team. Generally, they will stay with the team if the driver moves on. They're often people who one day might become a race engineer and run the kind of execution of the weekend. But actually, and I think increasingly, there are performance engineers who see really that is their expertise. It's a very, very driver-focused role, and that's what they want to do.
I think that's a really interesting way to put it, a sort of driver coach almost. That's a really interesting comparison to make. Is it a comparison you've made because you've got experience in other sports as well?
Yeah, so I used to be on the British rowing team. I did the Olympic Games twice on the British rowing team. And one of the interesting things actually coming from rowing to Formula One, in rowing, still the prevailing mindset is that the equipment is completely standard. It's not completely standard, but that's the mindset. And therefore, the performance is entirely based on what the athletes do. In 2008, when I started working in Formula One, actually, the mindset was pretty opposite to that. It was more or less that there's all these top drivers who are capable of being world champion, and we have to give them the car to do it. I think over the 15 years that I've worked in Formula One, that mindset has shifted. And now there's a more balanced view between car and driver performance, and a clearer awareness that part of the role of the team is to get more out of the driver as well as more out of the car.
That's fascinating, isn't it, Katie?
It really is. I love that approach, and what a great resource for the drivers you guys really are. How do you really take the driver's performance in the car, analyze it, and find ways to improve it?
So I think the tricky thing with F1 compared to other sports is that the cars are so fast that you can't really watch. Like, you could, you know, in the old days, sometimes you'd have driver coaches who'd go and stand on the inside of turn four with a stopwatch and try and claim that they were helping in some way. But the reality is
or
very
holding it
difficult.
With a video camera and watching, yeah, like the original,
absolutely.
The OG onboard. Yeah.
It's very difficult to do. And the problem with an onboard is you could only see the steering wheel. And driving a car, to be honest, a lot of it is not about the steering wheel. A huge amount is what you're doing with your feet, how you're timing the downshifts or the upshifts. And that you don't see from a video. So coaching visually is incredibly difficult, or let's say coaching purely visually is incredibly difficult. All you can really see is the line the car is taking. But even very often, the line is a consequence of the driver's input rather than a specific target that he's aiming for. So what that means is that coaching effectively is done from the data coming back from the car. And maybe you link that to the video to help explain it to the driver. But a lot of the kind of understanding of like what does good look like in this corner with this car on this day, that pretty much has to come out of hardcore data analysis. And so what you're looking for in a performance engineer is someone who can balance being able to do hardcore data analysis, like proper tough engineering interrogation of the data, and yet also someone who can whittle that down into a simple concept that the driver can process and deliver despite having to hit the brakes at 340 kilometres an hour.
So just to be clear, you're analysing a driver's performance in the car through looking at data. I'm guessing that data breaks into things like the way they brake, turn, accelerate, racing line through the corners. Is it that sort of data you're looking at?
Yeah, so it's primarily the channels that the driver is in control of. So that will be the steer angle is the obvious one, but you could get that on the video. The ones you can't get off the video so easily are the timing of the shifts, the brake pressure, and the throttle application. And the interplay between all those is effectively the big challenge between... that's the big challenge of driving a Formula One car, right? And the way that tyres work, they can give you only a certain amount of grip in a certain in any direction. So if you are braking as hard as you can, the tires have no extra grip that you can use to turn the car. And if you're turning the car as much as possible and you touch the brakes, the car will spin because there's no extra grip available. When you drive a road car, you pretty much never brake as hard as you can. You pretty much never put the car on the limit in a road car on the road because it's dangerous driving on the road. So you always have a little bit more grip available. You can brake and stop more. You can turn and turn more. But in an F1 car, you're braking. Everything is at the limit of what the tyres can do. And so the biggest challenge, I think, in this generation of Formula One car, and possibly in every generation of Formula One car, is switching from maximizing the straight line braking. You've then got to release the brake and apply the steer, but you need to stay on the perfect trade between brake and steer as you go between the two. You don't want to maximize straight line braking, then you're nowhere near the limit as you're trading between the two, and then you're on the maximum of lateral potential of the car. The timing of coordinating those inputs is probably the biggest challenge of driving these F1 cars. As I say, obviously then from the apex of the corner, the throttle comes in instead of the brakes and you're trading in the opposite direction. But the way you use the brake and the way you use the throttle affects which axle is on the limit as well. So when you hear drivers talking about the balance of the car, this car's understeery, this car's oversteery, a lot of that's in their control based on how they brake, how they apply the steer, when they pick up the throttle. As they go into the middle of the corner, they're often trailing just a very small amount of brake pressure, maybe 5% of their peak brake pressure, just to keep the car on the perfect line into the corner, the perfect amount of rotation, leave the perfect amount of lateral grip available while still slowing the car to be able to turn more at mid-corner. So it's a really intricate dance that they're doing, if you like, between their hands and their feet. And the problem, let's say, of just watching a video is that because so much of that control is happening with their feet, you don't see that in the video.
That's unreal.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, me and Katie
have had the same reaction, because also there isn't just that balance between braking and steering and getting that balance right. Katie, these guys are doing this at such high speed.
Yeah, you know, it's unbelievable. And I think it's a role that, I mean, being involved in motorsport for so long, it's a role that is so pivotal, but also like not unforgotten, but it's just an unknown. And it's almost like you're the liaison between all of the data and all of the team. And that's, you're basically the input into the driver to have that communication skill set, to be able to have that same lingo as a driver and be able to share in a bite-sized way as to what's actually going on.
When you're talking about coaching a driver to drive the car in a slightly different way, one of the challenges, it's one thing to be right, like, you know, to analyze the data and realize this guy needs to carry less brake pressure as he's applying steer, he's asking too much of the car. That's fine. Now the problem is, if I'm the performance engineer trying to get you to drive the car better, I have to first convince you of that fact. But it has to be so convincing that you can deliver it at that speed that effectively it's, you know, it's almost closed loop. Like, it's not like you're thinking through, you know, the human reaction time is, let's say, quarter of a second. But we're talking about changing things by, let's say, 10, 20 milliseconds. So you can only do that if you kind of go into the corner with a plan of what you're going to do. And the only way I'll actually get you to do that differently is if pretty much if we get to the point where you think it was your idea. So
that's
an incredible game of trust too. I would assume your background and your sports and your athlete, just that probably helps seal the deal for some of these other athletes. They know that you kind of have a racer mindset and an athletic mindset in the overall. And I think even going back into that communication world, how do you actually communicate with the drivers? Is it a sit down, chit chat, have a glass of water, kind of a cup of coffee? Or are you in these sessions? Are you in their ear at all times, also punching away and another voice that's heard?
Generally, and certainly at McLaren, the performance engineer will often talk directly to the driver while the car's in the garage. On track, it's only really the race engineer who talks to the driver, because we keep things simple. So the performance engineer will pass me messages of what his opportunities to improve are, and I will relay them as part of the information that gets passed to the driver. In the garage, the performance engineer is regularly talking directly to the driver. And then as soon as the driver's out of the car, they'll normally sit down with the performance engineer, work through the data together. All these drivers are phenomenal at looking at the data themselves, and all of them can do a lot of the kind of analysis that a performance engineer is doing. But as I say, the challenge for the performance engineer is there are so many channels they could look at, because I've obviously, when we spoke earlier, I simplified down to being just the ones the driver could control. But other things affect the balance of the car as well, the tire temperatures, the wind, the distance to the car in front, the brake temperatures, the way the electronic controls like the differential and the brake balance on the car are set up. And there's too many channels for the driver to be able to process all of them. And that's why, you know, when I described it as a hardcore data analysis task, is because these performance engineers are looking at, you know, there's 4,000 channels coming off the car. Now, most of those aren't relevant to a performance engineer, but there's probably, let's say, 400 to 500 that the performance engineer really needs to spend a lot of time on and needs to know very clearly, like, this is what I expect good looks like from these channels. This one is deviated from what I think it should be doing. Why is it deviated? Is that in the driver's inputs? Is that tailwind? Is that some kind of temperature related issue? Is that the slip on the tires? So they're picking through, you know, vast quantities of data, and that's why it's such a challenging job. And they're all super busy, which is probably why you never hear of them, is because they're sat in the top of an engineering truck somewhere poring over data, trying to understand, you know, exactly what these drivers need to do to get more out of the car. And obviously, with when I talked about building the trust with the driver, they need to not be wrong very often.
And you talk about getting the best out of the car. To do that, you need to get the best out of the driver. To do that, Do you have to fire them up or calm them down?
That is certainly very specific to the driver. Generally, you need to calm them down. The red mist is pretty much never helpful when you're driving a car. Normally, that results in a large shower of carbon fiber parts. So, generally, you have to calm them down. That's not always true, and there's still a balance. The most important thing you have to do is to make sure they have a plan. And actually, a plan that is strong enough that it cuts through whether they're calm or stressed, because they're kind of delivering this plan. But it's certainly driver specific, and there are one of the challenges, and this more is a race engineer thing, as the person talking to the driver is understanding, is he stressed, is he calm, is he pushing enough? But by that, a lot of it is, does he understand what's going on in the race or the qualifying situation to know, like, yes, I need to get the very maximum out of the car right now, I just need to keep the tires because they'll be better later in the race. So a lot of the psychology of keeping them calm, geeing them up, is around them kind of understanding the picture they're in the weekend, and even in qualifying it, you know, the McLaren's a good car at the moment, which is very nice. That means there are times, in particularly say in a Q1, where it's more important to deliver a clean lap, because that should be good enough to progress, than to feel like you have to get the last 10 milliseconds out of the car. When you get to the final run in Q3, you're looking to find the last 10 milliseconds. So the psychology changes through qualifying. The truth is, these drivers, they get to Formula One because they have very good psychology. Like the ones who can't stay calm, who can't get up for it at the right time, who can't deliver a lap when it counts in qualifying, I've not worked with them because they don't get to Formula One. Like, it's survival of the fittest, and they probably didn't get through karting. So a lot of it, the psychology is actually kind of giving them space to do what they do and not trying too hard to kind of manage things where you've got people who, you know, they're kind of self-selected to already be pretty good at this.
Yeah, that's where that coaching comes in, right? Knowing when and where. And taking it from the driver into the race engineers and strategists and making those final calls in the race, how do you all work together to make sure that you are on the same page there at the end?
I mean, in many ways, from an engineering point of view, that is the biggest challenge of going racing. The best teams are better than the sum of the parts that work together. There's a kind of, we have this hive mind idea, like when it works really well, everyone's little ideas and thoughts and kind of half-baked plans come together into this kind of perfect execution, where everyone's ideas have been taken on board, nothing's been missed. But often when it doesn't work, it's the kind of pub quiz problem. There's a yes and no, you know, there's a right or wrong answer. Someone will say, I think England won the Football World Cup in 1966. And someone else might say, I think it was 1972. And that makes the first person doubt themselves. And then actually you kind of do worse than you would have done if it was just one person. So that is the kind of the ultimate challenge. I guess the answer to how we work together like that is using this very complicated intercom system. We have lots of different channels on which sub conversations can happen, and then we try and bring that together into some main channels where the kind of big ideas are shared and agreed, and then that is communicated through the race engineer to the driver. Very often we work with people who come out of aviation or the military, and all of them think we're crazy for using so many channels.
Yeah, big game of telephone there, making sure that what you're hearing and then you give it and deliver it is equal. When it comes to calling those pit stops, is there ever a time where maybe a race engineer would disagree and overrule a strategist, or vice versa? And that goes back to that song and dance.
Yeah. So one of the things that we'll try to do is to define, if you like, who's holding the ball at any one time, like whose decision is it? Because there are situations where the race engineer is best placed to make a decision. There are situations where the strategist is best placed to make a decision. And there are some situations where the decisions get made kind of as a team across both cars, rather than being one car's race engineer or strategist, because you have to, you know, the two cars are close together on track and you have to coordinate them. So we try and kind of define how those switches happen. I think one of the ways to like using the intercoms, I get very good at task switching between picking up background conversations, picking up keywords in conversations that are happening kind of in channels that are turned down, quieter or whatever. It's a characteristic that annoys my wife a lot.
Tom, we know you're a busy man. You've got to leave us in a few minutes. But before we let you go, we've also had a couple of listener questions about race engineering. Now, we've looked at this in a previous episode of F1 Explains. We've dived into the role of a race engineer, but you've also been a race engineer, as we said at the start of the episode, for many drivers, Stoffel Vandoorne, Carlos Sainz, Daniel Ricciardo, and now you're the race engineer for Oscar Piastri. So let's dig into this a little bit. We've had some voice notes on this one.
Hi, this is Christina from Doylestown, Pennsylvania. I got a question about race engineers. This has been a very busy year with teams switching around drivers. My question is about the race engineers. When a driver switches a team, what happens to the race engineer? It's a pretty critical, personal, very, very essential role to the driver. So how does a new one get assigned or what happens there? Thanks. Love the podcast. F1 rules.
The race engineers are all employed by the team. They're not employed by the driver. They're employed by the team. So each team has, generally each team has two, one for each driver. Occasionally, I think now some teams are looking at having more than one for each driver and using that to help deal with the number of races on the season. But effectively, each team has two and they're employed by the team. They've generally worked at the team quite a long time. And so if the driver switches team, the default would be that race engineer works with the next driver to join the team, which is why I've worked with several drivers within McLaren. Very occasionally, when a driver leaves a team, they may say to their race engineer, look, I'd really like it if you would come with me to go to my new team. They then obviously need to also convince the new team that they want this race engineer from the previous team. That, I'd say, is very much the exception rather than the rule. I've never switched teams, but I think that switching teams as a race engineer is very difficult because one of the parts of the race engineer's job is being the link between the driver and the technical part of the factory. And if you're completely new to the technical part of the factory, you have to do a lot of work to just understand who the people are, the way that team operates, what information needs to be conveyed, that sort of thing. So it's not easy to switch teams as a race engineer. I don't believe people do it, but it's not easy to do.
Well, we know that Pete Bonington or Bono, Lewis Hamilton's race engineer, is going to stay at Mercedes and won't be coming to Ferrari. I guess that feeds into what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I imagine that at some point, Lewis will probably have spoken to Ferrari about who his race engineer might be. I imagine that it will be the guy that's currently Carlos's race engineer, Ricciardo Adami, who's a very, very experienced, very competent engineer. And that Ferrari probably convinced Lewis that, you know, better to stick with the guy that they've got in place. And I also know that Bono's been, you know, in that team since before it was Mercedes. So equally, he probably looked at it and thought, do I really want to move to Italy? Would I like to be somewhere new? How long is Lewis going to stay there? Because again, if you follow a driver to a team and the driver doesn't get on there and only stays 1 year, you know, the race engineer is probably going to stay longer. So there's a lot of decisions that you would have to make if a driver did try to take you with him. But I think it's, as I say, I think because of that, it makes it pretty unusual.
Has such so much depth to all of that. And here on F1 Explains, we do get a chance to talk to so many different people in the field. And to be in their roles as a job is something that is so interesting. Well, Maria from Spain, one of our listeners, says, I would love to work as an F1 race engineer in the future, but I'm unsure of what course I should study and what my steps should be. Different course for everybody, I'm sure, but what advice do you have?
Most race engineers and performance engineers have studied engineering at university. I think it would be possible to study mathematics and get into that position, but generally they've studied engineering. It's a mix of different kinds of engineering, maybe mechanical, maybe aero in some cases, less obviously connected branches of engineering. But the key thing is you need to be a very, very strong engineer. So go to the best university you can get into, do the best engineering course you can get onto, and get the very best grade you possibly can, which I know kind of sounds obvious, but it's definitely go and do engineering if you want to be a race engineer. Then the other thing that teams are going to be looking for is ideally some understanding of motorsport, and Formula Student is a perfect training ground for that. That's not necessarily critical. I didn't have a huge involvement with Formula Student, but the alternative, let's say in race engineering, then some kind of understanding, not so much of necessarily having performed in sport at a very high level, but understanding the kind of coaching process and how you develop, I'm just going to say athletes in general, I think is beneficial. The thing I would say, because I think it's useful, is that the race engineer is one of the, let's go with glamorous roles within Formula One. You know, you're facing the driver, you're at the track all the time, you're sat on the pit wall, you're the voice people hear on the radio, all of which is, you know, is cool, frankly. But on the other hand,
I love that he still says it's cool.
On the other hand, you're away from home for 24 weekends a year. So that's literally 50% of your weekends written off in a brushstroke. It's a life on the road. You're staying in hotels almost 50% of the nights of the year. That sounds incredibly cool, but it's also quite draining. It's a big toll on your family life. And what we find is a lot of people come into F1 wanting to work as a race engineer, but when they kind of see the reality of it, a lot of them actually prefer to do performance-based roles within the team that potentially are supporting from the factory during the weekends. And the pool of people who become race engineers, there's obviously only 20 race engineers because there's only 20 cars, but quite a few people think that's what they want to do, and then they realise it's not for them.
Tom, your insight has been absolutely fascinating. We really appreciate it. Thank you for taking the time to join us on F1 Explained.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So great to speak to Tom, and I don't know about you, Katie, I think one of my favourite F1 Explained guests. I really enjoyed that.
He was so conversational, Christian, and also I think some of his real life experience, whether it goes back to being a medalist in rowing, or all of his experience in racing in Formula One, he understood it. You know what I mean? Like, you could tell he had an athlete mind, the way he operated.
And one of the real pleasures about working for Formula One, one of the many reasons I love doing this podcast, is speaking to ridiculously talented people. Of course he's been in an Olympics, and he's also in Formula One as well. These people that find their way into this sport are just incredible, aren't they?
You know, they really are. And I think that goes back to kind of answering, you know, Maria's question of how do I get there, right? And there are so many different paths to get in, you know, getting involved in Formula One. I want to piggyback off of what he was talking about too, Christian, offline. We were saying this is such a people sport, right? So not only do you have to have the mathematics and the science and the engineer and the understanding of it all, but it seems as though the 20 race engineers that get that are in these roles, that it's such a high point of a position, they also have to understand people. They have to communicate for the receiver. It's almost like, yes, study engineering. At the same time, you should also maybe study psychology. So you better understand how to interact with others, because it's not just stats and figures. It is a full web of communication.
Absolutely. And something Tom mentioned in terms of getting involved was Formula Students. That's a European program. It's part of the Institution of Mechanical Engineers. If you are looking for more information on that, it's best to just search for Formula Students. And there is loads of information on the Institute of Mechanical Engineers website about how you can get involved. And there's lots of good general advice on there as well. Even if you're not European based where the program is, there's lots of really good advice on there about how to get into engineering on that website. So just search Formula Students.
Yeah, big thanks again to everyone sending in your questions, both about performance engineers. I know I learned a lot.
Tom was great at answering your questions. And of course, if you've got a question about Formula One that you're unclear on, F1 Explains at F1.com is the place to send your emails and your voice notes. We might make it into a full episode like this one, or we might use them in one of our quick fire specials. So F1explains@F1.com.
Yes, Christian, we do appreciate the emails, and also get your tickets for the rest of the season and next season. 2025 is quickly upon us. And of course, you can join us for some F1 Explains live shows, or just go to the races, tickets.formula1.com. We'll give you all of the details, all the insights that you might need to enjoy a race and why you should go to a race. Christian, we now know the answer here on F1 Explains.
Absolutely. But that is it from us for now. We are back every Friday with new episodes. Please don't forget to like or follow or subscribe to us. Tell your friends about us too, if they are Formula One fans, or even if they're not, they might want to learn about the sport. And coming soon to F1's other official podcast, Beyond the Grid, we have an in-depth interview with Mr. Tom Stallard. If you want to hear more from Tom about his fascinating journey into Formula One, as he was telling us, from being a Team GB rowing star into the Formula One paddock, he has been speaking about his life and career with Mr. Tom Clarkson, the host of Beyond the Grid, and also F1's race preview and review podcast, F1 Nation. Go and subscribe to those and you won't miss out. Do make sure to check them out. And coming soon as well to F1 Explains, Mr. Liam Lawson, who, in case you missed it, has been announced as replacing Daniel Ricciardo at RB for the rest of the 2024 Formula One season. He will be talking us through how Formula One drivers prepare for a Grand Prix on race day. That is coming soon to F1 Explains. But that's it from me and Katie for now. We're back very soon. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.